1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. This is Your Turn, a live call-in show featuring spirited discussion and debate about issues that matter to the community. Your Turn is sponsored by People's First Community Bank, the best bank in the neighborhood. Stay with us to hear what Northwest Florida thinks. Better yet, call in at 623-1330 and tell us what you think. It's your turn here on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. Now, here's the host of Your Turn.
Good afternoon. My name's Renee Giacchino. I'm corporate counsel for the Center for Individual Freedom, and I'll be with you for this version of Your Turn, the program that I've dubbed Meeting Nonsense with Common Sense. And we have a very busy program for the next 2 hours. We're going to start out talking about the U.S. Supreme Court. They just opened up their next term, the October 2007 term. We're going to look back a little bit at what happened in the prior term and how that sets us up for this brand new term, which just started last week. And then, lover or hater, you're going to want to stay tuned and dial in, because we're going to have right here on 1330 AM WEBY Miss Ann Coulter. She joins us at 4:30 to discuss her most outrageous book ever. It's called If Democrats Had Any Brains, They'd Be Republicans. So she joins us at the bottom half of this hour. Then in the second half of the program, we're going to review another book called The Nanny State, How Food Fascists, Teeto-Tallering Do-Gooders, Priggish Moralists, and Other Boneheaded Bureaucrats Are Turning America into a Nation of Children. And then finally, we're going to talk about our kids at risk, how teen sex threatens our sons and daughters, and 7 ways we can protect our kids from the deadly epidemic of teen sex. We're going to be joined by a pediatrician, Dr. Meg Meeker. A little bit unusual topic for me, typically a very political program, but it's an interesting book and something we really probably do need to be talking about. That's what this book highlights. Without further ado, let me welcome back to Your Turn Tim Lee. He's the Senior Vice President of Legal and Public Affairs for the Center for Individual Freedom. He's right there just outside the Beltway to fill us in on what's going on at the Supreme Court. Well, Tim, no doubt the days are getting shorter, the temperatures are falling, and the leaves are changing color, which can only mean one thing, and that's that the Supremes are back, right?
I thought you were going to say that means my favorite time of your college football season.
Oh. But, no, you digress. So you digress. No, we're going to talk about the Supreme Court, but let me go back first.
Yes, and the temperatures aren't falling yet either, but yes, it's an exciting time of year right now, and this term really could have some critical decisions. And it's going to shed even more light on Justice Kennedy, who is playing a pivotal role. For the first time in history, one justice was on the winning side on every single 5-4 decision last year, and that was Justice Kennedy. So at this point, you essentially have 4 more conservative justices, 4 liberal justices, and one right in the – well, he's not right in the middle. He tends to lean conservative, but on some issues he goes liberal. And he's perhaps the most powerful person in America in a lot of ways, because the court's going to split 4-4. And he'll be the deciding vote in almost all these cases. So it's going to be a really interesting year to watch.
So no doubt he's anchored himself in what used to be the position held by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor since her retirement. And, you know, we've now got Alito on the court. And, of course, Chief Justice John Roberts, Justice Kennedy, has become that swing vote, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah, you know, and it's sort of troublesome to me personally, just because I think he relishes that role. And unfortunately, instead of coming down to a simple decision and coming on the side of the law, he muddles it. And he does precisely what Justice O'Connor used to do, and that is involve the courts even more into our lives. Because what will happen, for instance, is if you have a black and white rule, that makes for easy application at the trial court level. So, for instance, in a free speech case, if they had overturned last year the McCain-Feingold bill, for instance, and said, look, this is contrary to the First Amendment. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Well, that's pretty simple, and they could have overturned McCain-Feingold based specifically on that. But they chose not to. Instead, they limited it, which means more court involvement in the future. And so it's troublesome to me in the sense that I think Kennedy relishes his power. And I'm not accusing him of being underhanded about it or doing anything unethical, but I do think that there's a certain degree of arrogance there that might be coming into play. He knows his power, and I think he might be utilizing that to the same degree that O'Connor did to involve the courts even more in our lives.
Well, no doubt he has provided us an abrupt reminder, you know, that the conservatives have not taken control of the Supreme Court yet, as many had predicted once Roberts and Alito, the Bush administration, brought them onto the court and, you know, their nominations went through, obviously. But that hasn't happened. That didn't happen last term, right?
You're absolutely right. Again, with McCain-Feingold, that was one example of it. There were some good decisions. The affirmative action cases, they ruled against the school districts that were assigning students based strictly, essentially, upon their race, because it was the tie-breaking vote. And in many cases, it was really the sole basis upon which kids were assigned to schools. So they were better last year. There were some good decisions, but they certainly weren't perfect. And again, Kennedy was playing such a critical role that too great a role. Massachusetts versus EPA was a perfect example of judicial overreach, in my opinion. That was the case where the states were suing the federal government to control carbon dioxide emissions, and they said that the EPA has a duty to regulate that or explicitly refuse to do so and justify why it's doing so. And so that was difficult, and that was Justice Kennedy making the key fifth, stood for the key fifth vote there. And so that was a terrible example, and that was one of the worst decisions of last year.
Yeah, it is remarkable. As you pointed out, Justice Kennedy was the fifth vote in every single one of the cases that went 5-4 last term, and there were 24 such cases. All right, let's move fast forward to this term, which started just nay a week ago. You know, here we are 1 week into the October 2007 term. And I want to start out by talking about two of what will probably be the most notable cases to be heard this term. Those were cases that obviously cert grant was granted at the end of the last term. The first one being the detainee case.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell us about that? What's it looking like? When's it going to be heard? What do you know?
I'm not sure the hearing date on it. That is, I believe, Boumediene versus Bush, Al Oda versus United States. It's one of the detainee issues. You'll recall a couple years ago, the court ruled in 2004 in a case named Rasul versus Bush that foreigners had held at the Guantanamo military base could get hearings before U.S. judges. That was certainly a troublesome decision to a lot of us. And in 2006, Congress sought to block that. So what they did is, by statute, amended the law so that they would not have the hearings before the U.S. courts. And so there was, of course, an appeal of that law. And in February, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit had ruled that the law stripped detainees of their right to federal court. So again, what you've got here is if you have an enemy combatant captured in, say, Afghanistan or Iraq, and taken to Guantanamo Bay, they want to say that they have access to American courts. And you can imagine the trouble that can be created there. The most important thing that not allowing them into criminal U.S. courts is that it protects the sensitivity of classified information. So, for instance, if they were able to catch one of these enemy combatants through the use of classified information or eavesdropping or, even worse, insider information that they got from somebody working undercover over there, that would have to be brought out in a U.S. court. Whereas in a military court, there's much more protection for those classified bits of information. And you can imagine what trial lawyers would do to try to upset this and hammer at the war in Afghanistan and Iraq by using the courts to just become a circus for trying these people. And it's absurd, and hopefully they go the right way in this case, because Congress acted pretty pretty explicitly in this.
All right, well, pull out your crystal ball. What do you think is going to happen? How do you think the court, and probably really what we get down to is, which way do you think Justice Kennedy will lean in this case?
I actually think that he'll be okay on this. His history with this is a little bit better, and the law is just so explicit here. Congress acted unequivocally in stripping them of their right to the federal courts, and I think that'll be enough to keep their detention in Guantanamo and within military courts.
Okay, that's the terrorism detainees, those two cases that the court has agreed to hear this term. Another big case has to do with an Eighth Amendment challenge to the use of lethal injection, you know, a death row inmate case. What's up with this one?
Well, you're right that, you know, with the death penalty, it's one of those issues where people who are opposed to it are using baby steps to try to eliminate it completely by using the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. Some people think that the Eighth Amendment somehow prohibits the death penalty, despite the fact that obviously at the time the Eighth Amendment was written, they had the death penalty. So, you know, that, as they say in the South, that dog don't hunt very well. But nevertheless, by incremental steps, a lot of death penalty opponents use these types of cases to strip away further and further at the death penalty in America. In this case, what they're saying is that when you use lethal injection to execute somebody, that there's an amount of pain involved in that, and that therefore makes it cruel and unusual. You know, it's pretty absurd just on its face if you think about it. It's never painless to die. And, you know, one way of looking at it would be to say the people that they killed to merit the death penalty probably didn't go in a painless manner either. But regardless of that, lethal injection is a developed manner in America that is essentially painless, and you essentially go to sleep before the drugs that kill you kick in. And so it would shock me if they went on that. But Justice Kennedy has been known, I think, in the past to be a little bit more to the left on some death penalty issues. You know, as a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, he reversed himself in a recent case. I think it might have been 2004, 2005, where he said that people under 18 could not be executed. And earlier, I think about 15 years earlier, he had said they could, that it doesn't necessarily prohibit you from being executed if you're under 18. Some people around 16 or 17 years of age commit some extremely heinous crimes that can merit the death penalty, but he drew the bright line rule, reversing his own position from years earlier. So on the death penalty, he drifts a little bit left sometimes, and unfortunately this could be one of those cases, because if they rule that lethal injection is cruel and unusual, then by logic that leaves very little room for other alternatives that would be even less painless than lethal injection. So perhaps they could develop another way of lethal injection that would be less painless and work on it that way. But nevertheless, this really does pose a threat to the death penalty in America. And so we need to be careful watching out for that as well.
Okay. Let's move down the list. What about this photo ID cards for voters? What's the reality of that one?
Well, this is one where I think that we'll probably get a good decision. The photo ID, essentially the claim amongst the plaintiffs is that photo ID requirements when you vote are somehow discriminatory because, you know, people of different races might be more or less likely to actually have an ID. Perhaps a recent immigrant or a person of color, they might say that they're less likely to have that, or they'll feel intimidated at the voter booth somehow if they're asked to show ID. And this is in Indiana, by the way. But, you know, it's absurd, again, to think that you should just be able to vote in America without having to prove your identity. We obviously have a lot of people in this country who aren't supposed to be here, and if they can just walk in and vote without having to show ID, then you know, the entire process is thrown into chaos. And so I think we'll get a good decision in this, but again, that's almost intuitive just based on the illogic of saying that photo ID is somehow discriminatory. There have been a couple recent decent decisions on this issue as well, so I think we're standing okay on this one. Because some different types of photo ID requirements in the past have been upheld. So this, I wouldn't expect this to be a bad one, but again, you never know sometimes with the court. I didn't expect the environmental suit last year to succeed, so sometimes maybe Kennedy will pull a wild card.
Well, sometimes you got to shake your head and just wonder, how do some of these cases even make it to you know, the highest court of the in the land, in the United States? How do they even get to the courthouse steps of One First Street? And one of them I'm shaking my head at, Tim, is the crack versus powder cocaine disparity case. Mm-hmm. What's that one about?
Well, this deals with sentencing guidelines in America, and federal law mandates that certain sentences be imposed when somebody is convicted of selling crack cocaine versus powder cocaine. And the reason that is that crack cocaine is much more powerful, and there's much more violent crime associated with crack cocaine because a lot of the sale and distribution goes on at the inner city. The argument amongst the people opposed to the sentencing guidelines is that it's, again, racially discriminatory, because crack cocaine for an equivalent amount gets a much higher penalty than the powder amount. So, for instance, if one person is selling a pound of crack cocaine, the penalty for that is going to be much heavier than somebody selling a pound of powder cocaine. And again, the reason is that the inner cities were just suffering from horrendous crime rates during the 1980s, especially when a lot of the crack epidemic was hitting us hard. And so what Congress did is said, well, because this is particularly common in high crime areas, we're going to punish it even more. And they've done a pretty good job of reducing a lot of that crime by using it. But then what people did is turned around and said, okay, now you're discriminating against blacks because you're targeting the inner city for this, and crack cocaine is sold in more impoverished areas than powder cocaine is, and that's racially discriminatory. And so what had happened is one judge tried to say that he was going to depart from those sentencing guidelines, and so now the Supreme Court has to rule whether that's appropriate or whether the judge has to stick to those sentencing guidelines.
So do you think this is going to get down to, is crack the same as powder, or is it, you know?
Well, if it gets down to crack versus cocaine powder, then I think that the court will rule in the correct decision, because they'll be able to point out that crack cocaine is much more potent, and that it's distribution is surrounded by a lot more high crime and violent crime and the gangs that are associated with it and whatnot. Powder cocaine has much less of that. So if the case does turn down to focus on crack versus cocaine, it should be a good decision. But if they start looking at the racially discriminatory impact and the fact that more people go to longer prison terms who happen to be black because they're involved with the crack cocaine, then we could be in trouble.
Okay. All right, well, when we come back, we've got to take a real quick break here, Tim. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about a couple of the cases already on the docket. Then I want to talk a little bit about some major cases that the court could decide to hear this term. They haven't yet, at least it's to my knowledge, they haven't yet granted cert. So can you stay with us through this short break?
That sounds great.
Okay, we're talking with Tim Lee, Senior Vice President of Legal and Public Affairs at the Center for Individual Freedom, and we are talking about the Supreme Court's October 2007 term. We'll be right back after this short break, and please remember, at the bottom half of the hour, we're joined by Ann Coulter, so you'll want to stay tuned.
Now, back to your turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
We're talking with Tim Lee, Senior Vice President of Legal and Public Affairs for the Center for Individual Freedom, and we're talking about the Supreme Court's October 2007 term, which began a week ago. Tim, I'm actually going to jump ahead before we talk some more about some of the cases that are already on the docket, including the Supreme Court's business case of the year and also a couple of the others that it looks like they will be deciding that people definitely want to pay closer attention to, some child pornography cases, government bonds and whatnot. I want to jump ahead a little bit and ask you if there's been any decision made yet in the D.C. gun ban case, what that case is about and whether or not the court has agreed to hear that case.
To my knowledge, unless something has happened sometime today, they have not yet agreed to take the D.C. gun ban case. And for those out there listening who aren't familiar with it, Washington, D.C. has an extremely restrictive firearms law, which essentially prohibited owning any gun in Los Angeles unless it was registered, I believe, before 1976. And if you had one since then, if I'm not mistaken, it had to be disassembled, which obviously does you no good. If you got an intruder coming into your house, you don't have time to tell them to wait while you put your gun together to use against them, because Lord knows how long the police are going to take to get there. And that's not a criticism of the police, but that's just a fact of life in our society. But at any rate, D.C. had a very, very strict gun control law. And last year, the D.C. Court of Appeals ruled that that was unconstitutional, that the Second Amendment confers an individual right to keep and bear arms. The contrary point of view that people that are more liberal tend to advance is that the right to keep and bear arms is somehow held by this collective militia. And frankly, they distort the meaning of the Second Amendment when they do that. And the D.C. court came to the correct decision and said that this confers an individual right upon people in America to keep and bear arms, and they overturned the D.C. law. It was an extremely good case. and one of the most welcome that I've seen in years, but I'm biased. I'm an NRA member, and this is one of my favorite issues. But nevertheless, the D.C. has appealed that, and they're trying to get to the Supreme Court and get it overturned. And frankly, if the Supreme Court does accept it, this will worry me, because this is precisely the type of issue, and I hate to look into a crystal ball, but this strikes me as particularly the type of case that Justice Kennedy would look to split the baby and pull a Justice O'Connor by issuing a really muddled opinion that really doesn't settle the issue and just brings people back to court again and again and again, because what he'll do is use very vague terms like reasonable restrictions and whatnot, and he'll probably try to concede a little bit to the liberal point of view that this protects some form of state militia rather than an individual right. And so this actually worries me. I think we've got 4 good votes on it, but I'm not very confident in Justice Kennedy on this. So this one troubles me quite a bit.
Okay. Well, thank you for your opinion on that. And that's certainly one we're going to watch very closely. We got about a minute and a half left. I'm not going to come back to any more of the major cases that are going to be heard. We'll cover those as they are either argued or as they happen to be decided. But I do want to ask you whether or not what you've been hearing inside Washington, the first Monday in October obviously marked the beginning of the Supreme Court's October 2007 term, but it also marked the publication of Justice Clarence Thomas's autobiography called My Grandfather's Son, a Memoir. What are you hearing about that, Tim?
Well, I've heard a lot about it in terms of interviews, and it's interesting because, as you know, most of the Supreme Court justices don't grant interviews that frequently, and so to hear his voice out there and discussing it so openly has been really interesting. And for those people out there who can hear Justice Thomas on radio talking about his background and his judicial philosophy and the transformation that he underwent from a very radical left person to the much more conservative justice that we know today, and some of the trials and tribulations through the Anita Hill hearings, I really encourage you to listen to those, because it's very interesting as a personal story, but it's very enlightening as well on judicial philosophy. So I'm not sure if you're talking about that with Ann Coulter, but you know, I'm sure she has some good views on it too, because she's an extremely bright attorney. But it's quite interesting for the listeners out there. If you get the opportunity to listen to Justice Thomas discuss this book, and again, it's called My Grandfather's Son. And the title comes from the fact that Justice Thomas was essentially raised by his grandfather,
right,
who instilled that sense of discipline in him. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, well, we're going to try and get him for the show, so hopefully we can. All right, Tim, that's all the time that we have. Thanks so much for the Supreme Court Roundup. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll be right back after this very short break. We'll be joined by Ann Coulter, so I hope that you will stay tuned and call in. We'll be right back after this break.